Hey guys, before we jump back into the second half with Matt Gleason and Deb Cloudman and Chris Fort, wanted to just take a quick moment to point out that we did just hit the 5-year mark for the podcast. I mentioned that at the beginning of part one. And so I wanted to take a quick moment and see if I could convince you to, if you haven't already, donate to the show. Upon last episode, I got a couple of donations from a couple of guys who've already donated before. So if you have not donated the show and you would like to, and you can, I would very much appreciate it if you would by going to theconversationpod.com/support. And even if you could just make a $10 donation, it would be appreciated. If you can make a $20 donation or more, you will be receiving the bonus episode with Max Maslansky, as well as new bonus footage, a short clip from our 2.5-hour conversation with Matt Gleason that is an outtake that has Matt singing Lou Rawls and eviscerating his alma mater. So more entertainment, a nice little tidbit, give you a little taste of the inside environment of the conversation. Again, $20 or more donation will get you those things, and it would just be very much appreciated. It will give me the opportunity to keep the show going, and if I get enough of your donations, I will be able to pay Chris Ford and Cooper Lovano, who have been helping out. And there's a lot that goes on in the back end of the show. A lot goes into getting us the guests that you hear. So if you would like to contribute to that process, it would be very much appreciated, and thank you in advance. Now let's get on to the second half intro, kick in the music. This is The Conversation. As you know from that pre-intro, it is episode 166 with Matt Gleason, part 2 of 2, with Deb Cloudman on hand and Chris Ford in the background. So thank you for coming back. It is definitely more fun. Just want to say a couple things before we jump back in briefly. Yeah, tell more people about this episode. I can't believe it is not more popular. Spread the word. I think it's a fun one. And the second half is at least as fun as the first, as you will find out. Mainly, I just wanted to say before we jump back in that we do talk about the gentrification situation with Boyle Heights. I think between Deb and Matt, there are some very thoughtful comments made, and we do spend quite a bit of time on it. And I want to say that if you happen to be a one of the protesters, somebody who lives in Boyle Heights and is very passionate about it, I'm happy to hear from you, and we can talk about getting your thoughts included on the show post facto. Please do not send an angry social media message or email or what have you, because this is an invitation to participate. All right. So just wanted to say that just in case. Small chance that somebody who feels passionately and doesn't feel like we address the issue properly is listening. All right. I hope you enjoy the second half. I'll talk to you more on the back end, where we will once again be doing some bad advice. All right, talk to you on the back end. Thanks for listening.
But I've had, you know, lately, it's funny because I've had interns lately who, if I applied for a job with them, I could never get a job with them. They're way more on the ball than me. I'm like, oh my God, I had this one intern. I heard her name was Rosanna, and everybody knows her. She's a fixture in the downtown art scene now. Very striking, very intelligent, very organized, totally on the ball. If she says she's going to do something, she does it. I'm like, oh my God, if she had owned a gallery and I applied, I would have never gotten a job. Yeah. There's no way, you know? So there's people that have these, you know, your gallerist is going to be just as difficult, if not more. I mean, I know a lot of gallerists I've seen shoot themselves in the foot, but I've also seen people who hold out on what you might think is just principle, but then you find out, no, they were really holding out because they were demanding that somebody else have the same level of integrity and ethics that they themselves carried. Whether those were just aesthetic ethics or business ethics.
True. Are your interns for credit interns?
I've done four credits. I mean, you know what? Sometimes they just show up. I fill out a piece of paper.
Can I just tell you a little anecdote? Because this actually just happened today. Because I'm looking for, I've been looking for several interns for this second podcast that I'm starting, and I've gotten a couple. You know, just online that are willing to do it for no credit. You know, mm-hmm. It's fine. They've started. It's no big deal. And then I've been in touch with I may have to redact this, of all places. And I was just on the phone with a guy down there. I bet you know something about them. I was on the phone with a guy this afternoon, and he was like, "Do you have liability insurance? If you're going to do an intern for credit," and there was really no other option, because if I do it for not for credit, I have to pay the minimum wage.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I was like, "Are you kidding me? I just want to get the word out. That's all I want." You know what I mean?
Yeah. There's a bureaucracy there.
Yeah.
People have come to me and said, "Look, can I intern for you?" Yeah, and you know, within a day, whether it's going to work out or not. And I've had interns that were, everybody's different. I mean, I had one guy that was like, "Well, he's really good at lifting stuff. That's good." And then other people who were very like, all of a sudden it was like, "Oh my God, they really came in handy on this obscure thing that nobody else could do." And they called their cousin and everything was fixed or whatever, you know? So it's weird. But the college credit thing is, anytime you work with any institution, there's a bureaucracy there. You know, it's the clock's ticking on just when's it going to happen. It might not happen the first month, but all of a sudden there's like, "Oh, there's a form to fill out before we can do that," you know?
Right.
And, totally. And frankly, the best interns I've had are the ones that they really want to know what goes on in a gallery. They want to know.
Yeah.
I had for years with Coagula, I would have interns for the newspaper through some colleges, and right away they'd be like, "Well, what do you do for?" And some of them wanted to write, and that was great. And some of them, I remember one girl wanted to deliver the paper. She wanted to know what it was like to have a paper route, I guess. But it was great. It was like, "Wow, we have great distribution," you know?
Right.
It was like, great, you know? So, and you know, and you're still, I'm still friends on Facebook with a lot of these people who they come into your life, and, you know, and then some of them go on to good things, you know? I'm always happy for them, you know? But, you know, like, my dad met one of my interns, and he still asks, because she was so like on the ball. Like he talked to her for a half hour, and 3 years later, "Whatever happened to that one intern of yours? She was so on the ball." I'm like, "Yeah, she's way further ahead in the art world than me, you know?" But on the thing, like when I hired an assistant in 2009, he still works for me. He's my gallery director now, Brian Chagoya. And I certainly couldn't do 9/10 of what I do a lot of the time. A lot of time it's my vision and his elbow grease. But I hired him as a curatorial assistant in 2009. And I had a lot of people that were working, and there was this one woman was really on the ball. It was like, I was like blown away in the interview. Like, "Oh my God, this is like alpha art world conqueror right here." And then I was like, "I got to hire this person. This, you know, she already knows these people. She gets it. She totally gets it. Gets it as good or better than I do, you know, all create." And then all of a sudden I realized, you know what? She'd be with me for two. She'd work on half a curatorial project with me, and she's moving on.
Yeah.
This girl, she's going to be at the top. And I don't want to say, you know, I didn't hire her. I said, "Look, you were great, but you're probably overqualified." 2 months later, I walked into a major gallery in LA, and there she is. And then I noticed, the next time her name's on something, because she's already like, you know, moving up the ladder there. And now she manages an artist studio of one of the top five artists working in LA.
Right.
She's managing their studio. It's like, okay, see, it's like, oh good, I called that one. So sometimes you can get an employee, and you take a year training them, and you're thinking, okay, after a year this is going to be great, and then after 9 months they're gone. So, you know,
do you want to, are you, I couldn't help but wonder who this woman is that you've been talking about. Do you want to out her, or is this kind
no,
of
a, I would never. It's
you're
it's
just too discreet.
No,
for
it's
that.
Point, okay. No, it's pointless. I mean, I you know what, something I learned in the business of when I write is, when you go after people, is punch up, never punch down. So like, for example, Coagula, and all the time I wrote for and all the time I published Coagula, and in all the articles I've written, I've never gone after like a college MFA show.
Right.
I'll talk shit about academia and how I think it's pointless to spend money getting a degree these days, and that the jobs aren't there like they used to be. And I do have to change my tune on that. You know, I over the years, I taught at the high school for the arts, and, you know, I'm like a white guy whose dad owned his own business. And here's some kids, you know, their first time. I had to tell them, you guys got to go to college. You got inner city kids that have talent, or you have to go to college. You have to, you know, here I am. I couldn't just be, hey dudes, do it my way. I lost my train of thought. Shit. Don't leave that part in.
It's okay. You'll get it back.
Where were we?
You were, I think it came from punching.
Oh, punching up. Okay. Right. Yes. So I never trashed an MFA show. Right. I would never trash that. So you punch up. Okay. So this person is still like if somebody working at the front desk, we used to have a contest in Coagula. Who's the worst front desk person in the art world? 2 years in a row, the guy at Mary Boone won. The name is Ron Warren. So we had to stop doing it because it was like the same guy kept winning, right? And we would talk shit about the front desk people. And people like got on me right away. Like, you know what?
Yeah.
When you're making fun of like Leo Castelli, that's cool.
Yeah.
But when you're making fun of like this chick making minimum wage, she probably has an attitude because she's miserable working for that asshole. That's not cool. And I was like, wow. Okay, I'm with you on that. Because I'm, you know, like I take Lyft, not Uber, because you can tip on Lyft.
Yeah.
Okay, you know, that type totally. Of thing. You know, unless there's a surge. But if there's a surge on one and not the other.
But let's not go there.
Yeah. But you know, so I have certain ethics that I would operate under. So right. So the one thing I definitely is you punch up. So you never.
I think that line that you had about she's miserable because her boss is an asshole. I mean, that's such a concise way of describing, because it's come up before briefly in conversation about, you know, what it's particularly in letters I've gotten about gallery desk people, you know, and what the deal with that is. Because as a gallery goer, you know, when you go in and the gallery is flush with all this attitude, you know, you kind of resent that, and it colors your experience of seeing the work. But if you can recognize that, as you just said, you know.
Well, I'll tell you something funny.
Okay.
You can walk into many galleries and people will have attitude. And there's a variety of reasons. One, if immediately they don't think there's anything that you're going to do for the business, a lot of people have already been told, I need you doing this. Don't be chatting with people coming in.
Right.
Okay. When a big collector comes in, you chat with them. Right away, you look at people, you're like, I don't know who this person is. Right. Okay. But you go to an art fair. And let me tell you, you start giving attitude at the art fair and it's a different ball of wax, because anybody, well, especially like at the VIP preview and you go in, you know, like the first day of the art fair, by Sunday of the art fair, you're like, the townies are there, you know, even in Miami, you're glamorous as it is. It's like, you know, the townies and tank tops are walking through your booth. You're like, get out of here, you know? And, you know, David Zwirner already flew home on Saturday, you know, Saturday morning. So, you know, but when people know that when it's a possibility that you might be somebody,
right?
And of course the best thing to do is always to walk into a very new, naive gallery where they're like, hi, who are you? You know, that sort of thing is everybody's cool to them. You know, I call it, you want me to talk shit? I got a really good litmus here.
All ears.
This is my litmus. I call it the Peter Frank point. Okay. You go to an opening when you're in the art world, hey, there's Peter Frank, right? And you go up and talk to Peter Frank. Hey, Peter Frank, right? And then there comes a time where you're like, I don't want to talk to Peter Frank. There's got to be somebody besides Peter Frank to talk to, because you're already happy. Like, you're rocking and rolling. I call it the have you reached the Peter Frank point? You know, that's one of my little codes. So there you go.
Well, being the Frank almost ran down my girlfriend and I, I think I've reached the Peter Frank point.
Oh, he's you're way past with this podcast. You're way. So you've got this thing where you get established people. Yeah. You're way past Deb. You're way, we're you and I, if we talk to Peter, it's, you know what? The only time I tell you, I mean, you know,
don't
Peter,
worry,
Peter,
I'm cutting this
you
out.
You know what? Peter's a mensch. Peter's a mensch. I love Peter, but the only, basically if I go to an opening and if I start talking to Peter, that means it's like, basically it's a bunch of like, that's a real commentary on everybody else. Hey, all of you here at the, you know, all of you here at this gallery ought to step up your game.
I will say in relation to the front people who sit at the front desk, it is also, I think it's two things. On the one hand, I always love to see that people are nice and engaged, because I think it's part of the mission statement of a gallery. If you are good to your staff and you ask your staff and you say, part of why we're here is because we are designating a space for art, we want people to come in, it's a service to our community, as well as just, then people will reflect that. And I'm lucky and I have wonderful, wonderful staff. So I get to see that. But the other side to that is that what I said earlier, where this is a messy job and it's a hard job and it's supposed to look impeccable. People walk in and they assume that the people at the front desk, all their whole existence is sitting there flipping through art magazines and waiting to greet somebody. But you have no idea what phone call they just got off of,
right?
What, you know, 12 different kinds of shipping they're trying to organize while also wanting to talk to you. If they're nervous because the show just opened and maybe they don't feel like they have the questions that you might ask for that really esoteric, difficult, obtuse piece that's, you know, in the other room, and they just had somebody be an asshole to them about it because they decided that they weren't giving them the adequate. If somebody just yelled at them because there weren't prices, if somebody just yelled at them because there were prices, they take so many different kinds and flavors of shit from all of the rest of us, that I think we also need to, you know,
I'm going to go back
take
to
that with a grain of salt.
Flavors of shit are there?
many. There are so
allow,
many.
Allow, the only thing I could add to that, and I totally agree with everything you said, yeah, is when you walk in and they give you attitude, you have no idea of the bozos,
yeah,
that walk into galleries and say and do and ask the stupidest things. And they insult the fact that there you are. Yeah, I am open as a space where this thing, this dialogue can exist, and it's, they just come in and abuse it. They come in and shit on it.
Yeah.
And so that I have way more forgiving of gallery people's attitude than like when I didn't know as much about the art world as I do now, you know, in 1992, 1993. Yeah. When we used to have that, who's the worst front desk person. But I'll tell you, the worst people are just those yahoos who walk in,
yeah,
and start, you know, wanting to show you their art or starting a conversation with you. And you're like, I got some work to do. Are you really interested in the art here? Are we talking about the art? It's like you try. And so I have my policy. I tell this to the interns. I tell this to my gallery director, is let me know if you have any questions, and that's it. And if they have that's dumb good questions, it's, yeah, like, hey, you know, I gotta go, man.
I talked about this with Lauren Marinaro, who is the director of Foyer Messler. Mm. And she entertains people. But, you know, one of my favorite line was the yahoos, as you referred to them, come in and they would ask, how come there are no signatures on these pieces?
It's a good one. I've, yeah, had that one before. Yeah. Yeah.
I've gotten that one.
I've had, I mean, here to, yeah, me, like, that's, and I tell people like, let's say I have to go out for the day and somebody who's really never watched a gallery is going to watch a gallery. I say, look, if they're dressed nice, if they're nice to you, be nice to them, chat them up. I mean, it's better than surfing Facebook, right?
Right.
I go, but if they walk in, and we're in Chinatown, so we have a great indicator that you might not have here, Deb, in Culver, yeah, City, is when they walk in with a plastic bag with to-go Chinese food.
Right.
That's a big thing that they ain't there for the gallery. That they're just walking by and they're kind of looking in. Just say, let me know if you have any questions, and stay in the back room, and they'll eventually leave.
Right.
And if they ask to use the bathroom, just say, our bathroom flooded.
Awesome.
We go to Fu Chow. Just walk into Fu Chow like you own the place. So that's our standard line.
That is awesome. So Matt, so you started Coagula again. When was that? Just
this summer. Actually, it was an interesting thing, is I got a chance to, the Museum of Art and History in Lancaster gave a show to a photographer, and rather than do a lot of prints, the photographer decided to, he and I decided that it would be cool to do an issue of Coagula that was just his portraits, and he didn't know who to take out. So I said, let's just do all women, but not say it's a woman's issue. Cause yeah, that's the one thing I hate. Oh, it's a, yeah, oh, it's a woman's issue. I'm patting myself on the back. I'm going to do a woman's issue. I
love
don't
that you guys did that.
I just, it was like, look, we just called it Art World All Stars.
Yeah.
And then finally you're like, hey, there's no sausage on this pizza. And you're halfway through. I mean, people finally get it. And then of course people would say there's, oh, it's
Deb
a woman's
is bowing
issue
her head
with that.
Right,
but we nowhere in there do we say it. And so we had 160 women, and but really it was actually, there was a practical necessity. Cause if it was guys and girls, then it's all of a sudden a lot of people didn't get in. Okay.
Right.
So then there's a couple people who didn't get in. Why didn't I get in? I said, ooh, man, the photo of you was not flattering. Oh, thank you. Thank you. And then every once in a while, the woman would say, I didn't really like the photo he took of me. I was like, you know what? He had four. I picked, that was the best one by far. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So, you know, there was a few outs we used in that. And then I wrote a short, not even a paragraph, right. like 2-3 sentences at the most on the 160 people that were pictured. And the museum paid for it. So that was the best thing was I kind of got going. And then what happened is I just thought, and then I thought I'd be doing these special issues on occasion. And then people started hitting me up for advertising. It was like, you know, I did the math. Okay. Well, that issue's paid for. That issue's paid for. So let's do it. So why not?
Where I was going was between that, where that's going to go, and then with HuffPost, right? Yeah. Are those going to give you the scratch?
I'm lately I've been disappointed with how the Huffington Post has treated its independent bloggers. I used to be very enthused when I would get enthusiastic response. I don't get enthusiastic response from the HuffPo, so I'm less enthused about participating. But if I, if Peter Frank almost ran me over today, I would probably, you know, if I wanted to write about something that I wanted people to read on the Huffington Post, I still have my account and I would get on there and there's a number of people that I recommended to get on the Huffington Post who still, like, if I, you know, that still blog for it. It's a great platform. I think you would get more readers on the Huffington Post than you will on a lot of, but everything with the art world is really contingent on, like, for example, if you wrote for Artsy, more art, real high end, top of the pyramid, and which I believe there is a pyramid, there is a hierarchy. I know there's people want to say there's multiple art worlds, and that's just a way of escaping scrutiny on their role, which is back to what we were saying about the art world being a small place. You know what? People want the benefit of being a big shot in the art world, but they want to be a small-time person when it comes to an examination of them vis-a-vis a celebrity, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the smallest celebrity in the celebrity world is bigger than, you know, like if you're on a Netflix series right now, you're bigger than David Hockney. Okay. But in the art, for art world purposes, oh my God, David Hockney is like, you know, a giant, you know what I mean?
Well, you know what Julian Schnabel said, of course. Well, his only good quote.
What?
Who's famous compared to Burt Reynolds?
You know, perfect, you know? Yeah. I mean, really? You want to hear a good story?
Yeah. Julian Schnabel story?
No, Burt Reynolds story.
Oh. Okay. I'll settle for a Burt Reynolds story.
I saw Burt Reynolds and Lonnie Anderson at an opening, and I think it was at Ace Gallery, but
would make a lot of sense.
This is a long time ago. It might have been like one of those, like, galleries that's long gone, you know, like Michael Cohn used to be partners with Jan Turner, like Cohn, it might have been Cohn Turner, and it might have been Ace, it might have been Manny Silverman, so long ago. And and I was like, holy shit, that's Burt Reynolds and Lonnie Anderson. And I got close enough to eavesdrop, and I cannot, and I cuss a lot, I can't even tell you what was coming out of Lonnie Anderson's mouth, but it was absolutely the filthiest single sentence I have ever heard come out of every. And what had happened is there was a kid bartending, and he was definitely underage.
Yeah.
And she described what she wanted to do to him, to his anus, sexually.
Wow.
To Burt Reynolds. It was the filthiest thing I've ever heard anyone say. And it was Lonnie Anderson.
Wow.
And this, he was like this cute, you know, he's like a boy toy doing the, you know, getting the tips, doing the bartending. And she was like enchanted with him. And she turned to Burt, and Burt just was like, you know, so anyway,
no.
there's your awesome. Burt Reynolds story.
That's awesome.
Via Lonnie Anderson. I mean, but Lonnie Anderson had the filthiest mouth I've ever heard. It was like, wow. You know,
well, you mentioned, I was kind of getting at, like, where's your provocateur, you know, sort of platform now, basically? I mean, is it
plateau? You mean
no platform? Like, what? Where do you spread your, you know, your frustration with the art world or what have you? I mean, it sounds like the new Coagula is going to be more of a punching high.
I've already gotten into a big trouble with one of the articles I've written in there. If you want,
Well, let's talk about that.
Look at page 28, man. Oh, I'm on.
Thank you. Okay,
I'm thanks. Really in.
Okay, page 28. Well, page. we're gonna edit this out. Oh, okay. So it goes back to, this is the same woman, right? Is this the woman from Thread Waxing Space?
No,
oh,
no, okay. no, 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 no.
Okay, let's see. Years ago, Shayna got a kitten and named her Jack Ruby. I'm looking for a name here that would get you in trouble.
Well, like I even took out the last names, and I'm still in trouble with Shayna. Shayna's not happy with the article we wrote.
Who is Shayna?
Shayna's a big time art writer, and her cat.
Oh, Shannon is Denver.
Yeah, her cat bit somebody and put this person in the hospital, and so we reported the news that this very well known person had put another very well known person in the art world in the hospital. And that because this cat had a history of attacking visitors who were other prominent people in the art world, maybe there was some negligence, but we really didn't even allude to that. But Shayna was very unhappy and has definitely let me know it.
But she had no grounds for defamation, right?
Hey, bring it on. I would, boy, a suit with her would be fun.
I have love for Shayna, so I'm going to be.
Yeah. And that's the thing. But here's the problem now. When I was a nobody in the art world attacking anybody in the art world, it's like, hey, you know, I was Teflon. What can you do to a nobody? But now I'm somebody, I have, you know, something to offer. I've already had people who were going to write about artists go, I don't want to, yeah, man, you're kind of, you know, so. Maybe I fucked up, you know, but it was like a story of like, I gotta write about this. I gotta, you know, Coagula has to make sure people know that, you know, there's, you know, if something out there happens, if you're somebody in the art world
right.
and you put somebody in the hospital
right.
and there's maybe some negligence because you've had enough warnings that you shouldn't be doing what you're doing that puts people in the hospital, you know, maybe, I mean, fucking Bill Lazaro and Art Scene aren't going to write about it. So, you know, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I wonder, though, if it's also people responding negatively to the kind of thing you were talking about before, where it's punching up, which isn't to say that she doesn't have stature.
Yes.
It doesn't say that she doesn't have stature, but to say that the way that you are perceived has also changed.
Yeah, so you know, you it's funny because you have a certain, it's the classic
right.
Nobel Prize winning literature Bob Dylan line.
Right.
When you got nothing to lose.
Right.
However, now I got something. So yes, that's a, right. a good way to put it. Maybe I didn't, maybe because I'm up, I am punching right. down or punching across maybe even. It's always funny what one's self-perception is. I always said, you know, the only honest description you'll get from somebody is when they're on an airplane to the stranger right. sitting next to them. They'll actually be a little more realistic about who they are, you
right.
know, like, well, I'm in the art world. It's nice. But then to somebody, I am in the art world. I am, you know, like there's a guy, I don't even want to say who this is, but you can edit this out. It's a Wikipedia page. Oh. And it's like 15 feet long. You're just like reading all this shit and you're waiting for him to cure cancer. Cause it's so self-important. So, you know, it's like, wow. But you know what I mean? Like when given the platform, people that, but they'll be more honest with a stranger, you know?
Well, who are your enemies now? I mean, or who are, maybe a better question is, who are the bad guys in the art world that you think need to be taken down?
Well, that's, you know, it's a lot different when I started out, you know, there was a real hatred of galleries. When I started Coagula, like making fun of the galleries got everybody. But what I found out, it was an envy of artists who weren't in galleries. They were happy that these gatekeepers, right. you know,
right.
Certainly as a gallery owner, I am shooting myself in the foot to say, you know, big time collectors. And the person with the biggest target on their back right now is Stefan Simkowitz.
Sure.
He's
been well covered.
Everybody
yeah.
wants to take him
yeah.
to him down. And he's got yeah. a bit of a Teflon thing.
I'm fascinated by everybody's fascination with him.
Right.
Well, it's a, you know what it is. It's a fascination of money because he's claiming. I don't know I do want to see the canceled checks, but you know, he's claiming that he is this great profiteer on art, which is the sexiest to most people, the sexiest thing in art. And the only person I can compare him to is Bernie Madoff. Is, you know, the economy's, ooh, you know.
You heard it here first, yeah. ladies and
I mean,
gentlemen.
I mean, basically, he needs that PR to get new clients because to pay off the old ones is my.
But he's been well covered. Who are your enemies?
Right.
My enemies.
Your people you think that need to be taken down.
You know, my enemies will always be the pretentious. The people who want to make art a social, you know, a social practice. Ha, do I take the people who want to make art a substitute for religion in religion's controlling, like you know what? I'm against the Taliban. Okay, like for example, these two women who went after Jerry Saltz the other day. Did you hear about this?
I didn't hear about it. No. Please bring us up to speed.
Did you hear about this?
I missed it.
Okay, well, you know the Facebook drama. Okay, so there's a Facebook drama where two women, two New York artists, did a, I can't call it a rant and I can't call it a tirade because it was pretentiously formed to be, it was pretend objective through a feminist filter and really called Jerry Saltz out on being, for lack of a better word, a bro, you know, like just like a frat boy type guy. You want to interject?
I believe they called him the Donald Trump.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, here's the thing. They basically called him, which is the easiest thing to say. It's basically, it's, you know what? You can no longer call people the Hitler because that kills, you know, that's Godwin's law. Once somebody says Hitler, they've lost the thing. So now they say Donald Trump. You're the Donald Trump of the art world. So yeah, they called him the Donald Trump of the art world. And then they had like this like 1,500 words of feminist theory verbiage, you know, and it was very much and it was a punching up. It was like they're two, whatever, mid emerging, you know, artists in the stew of 5,000 well-made object maker social practicers in New York that would get lost if they weren't doing stuff. And they went after the big dog, Jerry Saltz. And so I could see them as seeing Jerry Saltz as the enemy because he's a man and because he talked about a vagina and, you know, and that. And I just thought, and Jerry Saltz had the greatest line. He just said, "No Taliban, no Taliban." And that really, so I'm and there's a lot of people in the art world right now saying no, and we're not children. There are no children in the fucking art world. Okay. Except, man, there's might be a few collectors, a few trust fund kids. There's a couple artists that are big babies. I didn't say they were children. They were big babies. Okay, yeah. I'm doing this because it takes me back to my childhood, but shouldn't art be like emotions you have in a childhood? You know, no. Okay. So, but basically people who tell you, who speak to you as a child, that to me is the enemy. Academia is the enemy. I'm very much against, I just got into I have to go back and check on Derek Guthrie is starting up the new Art Examiner in Chicago again. And he'll come out punching. He's a great person to follow on Facebook, Derek Guthrie. And he, got into it today cause he said something about, he made a blanket statement and somebody went on and flattered themselves saying, well, you know, academics don't make blanket statements. They intellectually analyze. And then everybody had this little debate about academia. And I just dropped in like, you know, you parachute in, you troll and you jump out I said, academia, do you mean cancer? And is that like cancer for the art world or something like that? It's just something. And then when we were waiting to come on today, on your show today, I just happened to look at Facebook and there was like 15 comments. And basically people never addressed my critique of academia because they so took academia, which I consider to be a bureaucratic thwarting of creativity and ideas for a process of filling out forms and becoming a good soldier of the received opinion.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how many sentences that was. Don't transcribe that, please. But they immediately address this as being my saying fuck academia basically as being anti-intellectual.
Right.
That academia was the sole place that of intellectual activity, that it was a synonym of intellectualism, and it is not. It is most definitely not. It is the opposite of intellectual inquiry. I think academia is worse than it's ever been, especially in the arts, because the jobs aren't there, you know, they just aren't there.
Well, the frustration, one of the frustrations I've had is that I'm sure we all have to some extent is that you have these very small number of tenure track positions and they all seem to go to these star artists who are making a pretty healthy career as it is, you know, and then you have all these masses of artists fighting for these adjunct positions that are, you know, always being downsized.
You know, years back in an old issue of Coagula, somebody wrote me a letter like, oh, hey, I got a tip for you. UCLA was really the first to pioneer that art star. Like, hey, they're in museum collections and they're showing at the hot galleries and they're our faculty.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Chris Burden, how come you never show up to teach your class? I think your TAs ought to get paid more or something like that. And it was like one sentence in a Coagula. And it's funny because you look back in the Coagulas now and it's like, I'll see like a little article I wrote.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that everyone talked about for a year. Right. And then the big thing I wrote about that I put all this effort into that I loved writing. It's like, huh? You know? So I remember just that. That's when I realized how predominant academia was at the time. And it's not as predominant as it used to be, you know, because the kids are just not, they're not going into these programs. They're like, I'm not going to get into $90,000 of student loan debt to play Lord of the Flies for 2 years and then come out and you're still going to be teaching there, you know, screwing new 25-year-olds, not me. So, you know what, you know, that sort of thing. So, at the time though, just that one sentence where people wanted me to write academia gossip. So then right away I was immersed in this culture where, people would call me and say, oh, did you know that? I remember, I'll say this. I don't think I ever published this one, was Helen and Newton Harrison. It was this duo, and they basically planted weeds. That was, they planted gardens as their art, but they had to get two faculty positions. So whenever they always had two votes. So then they only had to get two more votes to vote whoever they wanted to come in, and just all that. So I remember somebody pointing that out. Helen and Newton Harrison are doing this. You know, you got to write about it. And I don't remember if I wrote about it, but right away I realized, oh, they're using me. But the guy who's calling me saying, you know, this person's doing this on the faculty hiring committee, he's probably the bastard who wants to do this on the faculty hiring committee. So I started telling people, oh, I don't do academia gossip. I don't. And then when I was at, I actually taught at Claremont. And I do not have a high school diploma. I was kicked out of high school and I was kicked out of five colleges. I graduated from eighth grade, St. Paul of the Cross Elementary, first through eighth. Only time I ever graduated from anything. Okay. And I told people that the first day and they were furious, but I taught at Claremont Graduate School. It wasn't CGU then, it was CGS. This was in the 1996 school year. I taught art theory. And, what's funny is sure enough, 2 years later, everybody who took that class from me, they'd see me at openings. Yours is the only class I wish I could go back and pay more attention, because you really were talking about everything that goes on in the art world. And I was trying to filter art theory through art reality, because I'm the only philosopher that matters is Machiavelli, because Machiavelli didn't write about the world as it should be, or as it might be, or as it could be postulated as. Machiavelli wrote about how it is and how to use that to your advantage. That, to me, that's, you know, start, you know, and that's where I got on and off the train. And so people would say, I want to read Foucault. You should be assigning us Foucault. And I said, well, one, you could read Foucault in your free time.
Right.
And two, you don't want to read Foucault. And if I assign it, you won't read Foucault. You'll have an excuse as to why you didn't read Foucault, but you damn sure want to be able to walk out here saying that you read Foucault.
I'm one of those people who actually really enjoyed reading Foucault. So I'm gonna say that I have a lot of love for certain elements of academia and the idea that there are spaces where philosophy can be discussed. But I totally agree with you that there is a sincere disconnect. And I remember the first time in college that my little idealistic bubble, as somebody who already knew that she loved philosophy and all of the rest of it, coming from the kind of privileged background where I had gotten to read philosophy already at 18. I remember being in a class that was on neuroscience, and there was a professor teaching the class and teaching about a particular theory that, you know, he thought was interesting. And then he talked about another theory that he also thought was interesting. And there were these two different schools of thought. And it was very obvious by the end of the class that what he believed was that both had some true points to them, right? Both of them had merit. Can I talk about the fact that you're eating an apple?
I don't have to point it out. Go ahead.
Away from the microphone. It's actually my favorite thing, because the angle that you are now looking at me at, and the way I wish that we had an image we could pose on. It's pretty fantastic. Eating the apple away from the
podcast.
Oh, that was so good. But by the end of the class, it was really clear that the professor, who I respected, believed that both had elements that had serious value and application to, you know, science as it was practiced and implemented in the real world. And I went up to him afterwards and I said, so it's clear that you think this. Why is it that nobody has combined these two theories. Why have these two theories not? And he said, well, because there's no funding for academics who, you know, aren't the ones who are finding and pioneering a new theory that they can then write about. There's no funding for the guys who say, actually, let's take a little bit of this one, a little bit of that one, and we're going to combine it and have practical usage. And I remember that being this moment for me where I was like, oh,
the limitations, yes, of academia, there's a based limitation on the, because of the culture of academia.
Because of the culture and because of the politics. And I love what you're saying about the constant conflation that happens between academia as referencing intellect, because I think that's absolutely true. When you say that you're anti-academia, people think, oh, you know, you don't want to think about things in a complicated angle. You want everything to be easy and accessible, when I think there's a big difference between...
Especially when it comes to art and studio art. The idea that reading and talking are somehow privileged over art making has really, you know, it's created this, you know, a generation of social practice artists who then want to get into the marketplace. So then there's always, you know, detritus from their social practice that you can sell in the gallery, I guess. Or they're from just an elite background where profit is not a motive, you know. So, you know, the market is evil because my dad can pay for school. Hey. So, you know, that to me is, but you know, the thing about Foucault, when I was an undergrad, everybody was talking about Foucault in like 1988, 1989. Yeah. Foucault. And I tried to read Foucault, and it was very difficult for me. I'll be straight out. I used to laugh. I just go, you know, I'm just not smart enough. I could not understand three pages of Foucault. And I used to mock the early issues of Coagula. I mocked Foucault. But years later, I'll tell you when it was, 1999, I got the flu. And I was at a girlfriend's house, and I had the flu, and I couldn't do a goddamn thing. And like, she didn't have cable TV, you know, she was a bohemian, no cable TV there, right. You know, no NFL, you know? So I was like, oh boy. And she had these books. So she had this book of Foucault interviews, and I read that thing front to back, and I was like, oh shit, I'm a Foucaultian. I agreed with everything that fucker said. And there it was. I'd been mocking him and mocking the people who read him, and his, and I was like, how could his interviews be so damn lucid?
Yeah.
And they were basically, obviously, they were conducted by the people who so understood
his
subject that they were able to dive in. But he, it was like so intellectually rich. It was like, oh my God, this is great. But see, my thing was like I was the kid, I was kind of a sick kid. And so I would, the library was where at recess, I would go to the library.
Yeah.
You know, I never went out. My mom's story was we would go to the beach and I would decide, you know, my brother would be figuring out like if he's going to take his boogie board, and I would be picking what letter of the encyclopedia I was going to take to sit at the beach and read the encyclopedia. That's right. I'm that kid.
Yeah.
So to me, it was like, why do I care about what the teachers assign? I want to, you know,
sure.
I would go into the library and just grab a book and read. And if it doesn't catch me, I go read another one. So I would always tell people like, why are you waiting for someone to assign you anything? Why, you know, I would, you know, like when I was into punk, you would read the interview and they would say, who are your influences? And they'd say the Velvet Underground.
Right.
And you know what? In 1980, there was no way there was not a Velvet Underground bin. There was no Velvet Underground. It was this thing that you could order the album.
Right.
And I did. And I ordered the album, and it took 3 weeks to get mailed. And there it was. The Velvet ended a banana. And I'm like, oh boy. And then it didn't sound like punk rock at all. But then all of a sudden it was like the greatest thing I'd ever heard. It was like, oh, it's like the blueprint for punk. And just because it wasn't hardcore, you know what I mean? But you had to like, you know, but nobody now, everything gets spoon fed and, you know, and the teacher assigned that it must be important. And I came from the attitude that I don't care if the teacher to me was never here. I was raised by nuns in educationally. Okay. I went to, and so once you had a nun teach you, no mortal, it's kind of like, you know what I mean? Like Bewitched, you know, it's like nuns are not, they're kind of like there's human and then there's nuns above and then the angels, you know, I mean, so once you've been educated by a nun, you know, like no, you know, you. So I never respected. I mean, I'm you know, good teacher is a great teacher. I'm happy with it, but I never had that. That's the teacher. That assumption that authority is correct.
Right.
Because the nun was always correct. Let me tell you. Woo-hoo. Mm. So, yeah. So, you know, shout out to Sister Aquila. looking down on us from above.
And nice callback to Velvet Underground, by the way.
Yeah, I know. Oh, yeah. That really all came around for me in a really beautiful way.
No.
Beautiful.
Yeah. But back in the day, I just remember it was like, you can't, and that's another way the punk bands would talk about Bukowski. Who's this Bukowski guy? Who's Bukowski guy? And then I had to find out who Bukowski was. There wasn't a teacher. The mediator was the source was the mediator, you know? And I think we've lost a little of that with academia, you know, don't you? Don't offer an opinion.
not only am I not going to offer an opinion, if I did, you know, we would have another hour to go. Yeah. So let's have a little editorial meeting.
Yeah.
Cause I want to get your support on this. We're almost at 2 hours with the intro and an outro. It'll easily be over 2 hours. Should I do as I did in a recent episode and make it a two-part episode?
Knock yourself out. We haven't even talked about the damn Boyle Heights like you had said we did.
I know.
I didn't say anything.
We didn't talk about Boyle Heights. We didn't talk about
Okay, let's do 10 minutes, 5 minutes for Boyle Heights and 5 minutes for the St. Louis thing.
Can you
okay?
guys chat for a second?
Yeah. So let's
I'm like,
let's start with the national one, and then we'll go to the more local one. How does that sound? And we got to keep it brief because we can go on this for hours.
Knock it out, man. Yep.
Okay. All right. So certain minds would not let us get away with leaving out a couple of topical issues. One of them is the recent thing that Chris just brought to my attention about. All the turmoil at the St. Louis, is it the St. Louis Museum of Contemporary Art? CAM.
Contemporary Art Museum.
Contemporary Art Museum of St. Louis.
I guess if you put the S for St. Louis, it would be SCAM.
And for those of you not up to date, basically, Kelly Walker had a substantial show there. He and the curator, Jeffrey Uslip, were doing a talk. The talk went incredibly poorly. Some very thoughtful and provocative questions were asked that were incredibly botched by the artist. And then the curator basically answered for him at a certain point. So the whole thing was a disaster that led to apologies from Kelly Walker, from his gallery, Paula Cooper, and also led to the curator leaving the museum. So I know we could go on about this for a while, but I think you could probably make this pretty concise, right?
Well, when I said about punch up, if you put yourself in the position of African Americans, it's definitely punch up to basically the white power structure mocking imagery of your community. First off, Kelly Walker is an abortion of an artist. I have absolutely no interest. I mean, when you make Richard Prince look profound, that's saying something about how pathetic your art is. Man, I mean, no, Kelly Walker is an abortion of an artist. It would have been better if Kelly Walker had never been born.
Wow.
If his art had never been made. I'll put everything up there.
Come on. This is a forum. This is an open forum. There's no need to hold back. Please.
Okay, I'm sorry about it if I beat around the bush and try to be diplomatic here, but you know, but I never liked Kelly Walker's art, and
I'm validated.
When someone you hate really fucks up, it's right. Like, oh, this is just...
Well, you know what's really the most interesting thing to me about this, it seems unprecedented from my memory, is that this is a case of an artist choking so badly in a public forum that it completely rewrites their career. I mean, I can't think of any other examples.
The
of
sad
this.
Part is it probably won't affect the career as long as you're with Paula Cooper and you right. know they can prop you up at auction, which
right.
they do.
Right.
You know, the storm will blow over. You know, barring a sea change in the fundamental culture of the art world, which I would hope is coming. But you know, look, St. Louis, man, the tin ear. You know, basically, look, the art world. By and for the elites, by and for a cliquish couple sets of clubs, you know, where the kids from CalArts get up on top over at this institution and the kids from Yale get over on that institution. And then they all kind of grow and intermingle here and there. That's basically the art world. And now, because they really are being asked to represent communities that they never rub shoulders with, now there's some fire to the feet. And I think we're going to be seeing more of this. I don't know that the museum, when they put up the wall, you know, and said, what's back here, you might be harmful to you. To me, that might've been the grossest thing. The way they talked down to people asking legitimate questions was infuriating, but it's that classic thing. You know, the absence of content in your work tells us as much or more about you than the content in your work. Mm. You know, people who can make art from a position of extreme privilege can have that privilege to just make art without content, you know, and it bit them in the ass. And I hope that bite never heals.
Okay. On to Boyle Heights.
You don't have an opinion on this. I thought you were going to pipe in too.
Oh no. I mean, I do. I have an opinion, but I have to say I have not been as well-read and on top of what's been going on. So I'm in more of a receiving
I am relishing what is happening to Kelly Walker. And I hope every single privileged white curator who walks around at these elite parties, who knows Franklin Sermons and no other black people, I hope that these people are just realizing that that plate of shit that Uslip is eating and will be eating for the rest of his life, that they're going to, I mean, when Jeffrey Uslip dies, if he's even worth having an obituary, they're going to mention this. He's going to be eating that plate of shit into eternity. And I hope every single person who funneled through LaxArt to Yale to wherever else you go through the nonprofit mafia, I hope every one of them realizes that institutional plate of shit, that they could be eating that too. And that real, and they really take a deep fucking breath and maybe, just maybe, get out of their comfort zone with who they socialize with and maybe meet some real people in this world instead of their fucking idiot friends from, you know, the idiot, you know, from what are those fucking, I don't even know the names of those stupid, what do they call the schools where you, the prep schools, the goddamn, you know, that's, it all starts at the fucking prep schools and never leaves. And I hope that they're realizing that plate of shit could be served up to them very quickly.
Harvard Westlake class of 97. Hey! Thank you very much.
Oh yeah. But you know, but compared to like Groton or something, it's
no.
No offense intended.
I'm owning it. I'm owning it more than.
All right. So Boyle Heights, full disclosure, Chris did make an effort to, these people probably aren't going to be listening, but you did make an effort, you made multiple efforts to get the key players in this Boyle Heights gentrification scenario to participate on the show. They all flaked. Is that the right word? Or what was the other one? They can all fuck, you can fuck off and go to hell. Is that what the other one was?
In New York, it's fuck off and go to hell. Right. But this is L.A. They just flaked.
They flaked. So I don't even know where to begin, but we've only got 5 minutes for this. So let's get right to the point. There's a lot of, I'm just going to try to boil it down really quickly. There's a lot of controversy in the Boyle Heights neighborhood of Los Angeles, which is quite, part of Boyle Heights is just adjacent to where one of the gallery districts in downtown is sort of expanding into. So some would argue on a technical level that it's really downtown. It's not Boyle Heights. But in any case, there are a few galleries there that have moved in. The locals, apparently, this is what I've heard. I can't remember if I heard or read this, but some renters have actually been kicked out of their places because the places have been taken over by new buyers. Anyway, that's just a quick roundup. We can take it where we will. Deb, you want to tee him up?
I'm gonna go for response.
You know, the art world is essentially comprised of, no matter how colorful it might be now, the art world is essentially comprised of white liberals. And white liberals want to believe that they're doing the right thing. And they're being, the extreme conflict here is they work very hard. Despite having no friends of color, they definitely work hard to do the right thing, be perceived as doing the right thing. And a lot of this goes back to what Dave Hickey would talk about with galleries and art being seen as a social good. You know, it's a good thing. So, right. So galleries, I have a gallery. If I tell people I have a gallery, hey, you have a gallery, an art gallery. That's a good thing. I'm giving to humanity. And so for everything to be turned on its head by these protesters has created a complete, complete like paranoia on the part of so much of the art world to say, okay, I am against gentrification, and yet I need to go to the opening at that gallery. What do I do? I mean, I have friends who own galleries in Boyle Heights, and so
how are they doing?
Well, they're not happy. I mean, you know, they're certainly being made to be the bad guy in a thing, but let's look at it. I have to talk about it. If you talk about it as a white liberal, you avoid the thing by, you say things like, well, what we really need is a dialogue. And you know what? Right. They don't, there's no dialogue here. There's the fundamental market realities of the fact that the housing near downtown, near the infrastructure of downtown, you know, they built the Gold Line to go into Boyle Heights. So all the poor people could get on the Gold Line. And guess what? Nope. They built the Gold Line into Boyle Heights because eventually the real estate was going to go up. And that's called gentrification. And it's funded by the government. It's funded, the same government that gives grants to nonprofit groups to give to poor people in poor neighborhoods. And so these nonprofit groups organize anti-gentrification protests, but they can't protest. They can't bite the hand that feeds them. So they find one complete group of, in all due respect, and I'm a gallerist, but in the scheme of things, you know, when you look at a company, a gallery is a company. Well, Apple is a company. Warner Brothers is a company, right? Warner Brothers is going to have its headquarters at 7th and Santa Fe, right over the bridge from Boyle Heights. You know, a quarter, less than a quarter mile from Anderson Street, where these galleries are in Boyle Heights. Warner Brothers is going to have its headquarters in a very large building that's being refurbished right now for them. Okay? That's a big company. But they're not picking on the government. The protesters aren't picking on the government. The poverty pimp nonprofits are not protesting Warner Brothers or the government. They're protesting, basically, when it comes to business, Warner Brothers, Apple, art gallery, we're the losers. Okay? So they're protesting the losers. But it's gotten them press. The genie's out of the bottle now. So the only way to address this is basically you're either with art or you're a guilty white liberal who believes all the gentrification stuff. So whose side are you on? Are you on art? Should a gallery, should artists and art galleries be able to go anywhere they want where the rent is cheap, regardless of the impact that that might have in some, you know, urban theory domino studies, which I kind of believe. I mean, I've seen a lot of gentrification happen over my lifetime, and I'm in the pursuit of cheap rent for studio space or for gallery space, right? So I'm in Chinatown, and people have said, oh, Chinatown has not gentrified, because Chinatown has rent control.
Right.
Chinatown has rent control, and the Chinese landlords, God love them, they want rent control. They feel a duty to their community.
God bless them.
For these old Chinese families, to poor Chinese families, the hillbillies of Taiwan, poor people, to have $300, $600 apartments that are market rate $2,000 apartments. My landlord, oh, he's this mean old capitalist with a bunch of properties. And man, I'm like, well, are you going to get rid of that family above the one gallery, the rent control family? Are you ever going to get rid of that and have that as a, you know, have some college kids rent it out for $2,000 a month? He's like, no, they're Chinese. I owe it to them. You see, I really respect China. Chinatown has not gentrified. Go to Chinatown. Right. There's still shitty $3 Chinese food there. So what's happening in Boyle Heights, though, is the spillover from downtown. You know, downtown I lived in the arts district when it was the drug district. Okay. So the fact that it got gentrified is for one reason only. It's near all the infrastructure. It's near, you know, there was a, you know, I remember when they got a dash going through the, what's now the arts district, when they got the dash bus there, it's like, okay, once the dash is here, watch, boom, you know, hey, it's easier to live. When I lived there, it was hard to live there. If you wanted to eat and it was midnight, the only place to eat, if you had a credit card, you had to drive to Glendale to the 24-hour Ralph's.
Wow.
That was the closest place that you could use a credit card. There was an ATM in Chinatown at the Bank of America. That was the only ATM in downtown LA for years, years and years. It was hard to live in downtown LA. Now it's easy. So the infrastructure's there. So Boyle Heights is, the struggle is, if you're a white liberal, you can't be on the side of art. Art is gentrifying that neighborhood in some domino theory. Now, are they picking on these people? Absolutely. Should they be picking on City Hall for rent control and growth that is going to include poor families? Absolutely. But who can actually get these 60 to 100 protesters that show up at these protests? Organized nonprofits who don't want to bite the hand that feeds them at City Hall, or grant organizations. So they're hiding behind this. They're going after these losers, these nobodies that are getting them publicity. I'm not calling galleries losers, but I'm saying in the scheme of things, there are people you could really aim at that gentrify neighborhoods much faster. Big developers, big government. But
I wonder, though, because I think that I don't know. You know, I wish that I knew more about the nuanced history of the area and the people who are protesting, as much as I've read lots and lots about it recently. Again, this is the problem, right? If I had a gallery in Boyle Heights, I would be going in there not knowing about the nuanced history of the area. I wonder how much of it is not being willing to bite the hand that feeds you, and how much of it is thinking that this is a part of the story that hasn't been told. So if you're trying to amplify an understanding of what happens with gentrification and how complicated that process is in holding out space for your neighborhood and the people who have created that neighborhood and community, it's a different kind of story to go after galleries. So on the one hand, you can say it's low-hanging fruit and, you know, it's not Warner Brothers. On the other hand, how many times have we read stories about people protesting large companies or developers? How much more interesting is it to have a group of people protesting galleries who, exactly as you said, like to think of themselves as being on the side of the good and promoting something in the community? So, I mean, I think it is interesting to say, clearly, there are all kinds of interrelated forces that are complicit in the process of gentrification. You know, I wish that I had talked to my brother about this lately, because he's actually an economist with a focus on urban planning and geography in California. So he would be a great person, and maybe this will be a postscript.
We'll have him back on, and we'll get one of these Boyle Heights people that's going to complain after they hear this. Yeah,
but I do think it's very complicated, and I think.
I see it as very simple. People in the arts, galleries and artists looking for studio space are going to go wherever the rent is cheap. The fact that they somehow affect, and again, I think it's an abstract theory with some anecdotal evidence that when they do that, things change and there is displacement. But I'm going to go where the rent's cheap, or I'm not going to have a gallery.
Sure.
But I don't believe that this, you know, the fact that the gallery, I'm a gallery, I'm good. I'm not subscribing to that theory that I'm some kind of angel because I do a gallery. But, right. But one thing, I guess, oh shit, I had a fucking good idea. Yes. If I've been around enough political activism in my life, I can tell you something. Getting media attention is the gold.
Sure.
Okay. And the fact that they've gotten media attention, they ain't going anywhere. This is going to be a reality.
I'm sorry. Well, forgive my total ignorance here, but are you talking about
the activists?
Okay.
The anti-gentrification activists were completely ignored until they started protesting the galleries.
Right.
And I think it was totally unfair of them to do that. And I believe that there are easier targets. Tactically, though, and I'm impressed because I wouldn't have tactically thought this. Tactically, as a political tactic to get attention to your cause, oh man, they hit the bullseye. You know, I mean, you know, Mao and Lenin in the depths of hell are looking up going, oh my God, I wish I was that smart as a tactical revolutionary. Yeah.
And then the galleries have become the demon.
Well, you know what? It's not even no, because the demon is always this. Well, what it really is, hey, let's not fool ourselves as liberal white people. People are graffitiing on Mihai Nicodime's door. Fuck white art. These are people who fuck you for being white. This is really happening.
Right.
There's no dialogue when it's basically saying, then we can get into the whole theory that only white people can be racist. Well, basically, this is an announcement. White people will ruin our neighborhood. That is what we're being told. White people will. So where do you stand on that? Should we just not go there? Is that, I mean, what do you do? I mean,
well, this is why I say that it's a complicated question as opposed to a simple one, right? Because if we're going to, we are not in the next 5 minutes going to go through and be able to talk about systemic racism and whether or not, you know, white people can be the victims of racism based on whether or not there's a systemic underlying issue that would allow power structure. I mean, I'm with you. I'm with you and I'm not with you.
Right.
But I would just say that is very, very complicated, which is why I say that all of these things are complicated. And as you said, this tactic has meant that we are discussing gentrification using different terms than the standard terms that people have now gone to the point that they can dismiss, right?
Exactly.
Because how often over the last however many decades have we talked about gentrification in terms of development and what happened in New York, what happened in Soho? And so I think that tactically it makes sense in terms of deepening the discussion in certain ways. Mm-hmm. Do I like that people who I care about and relate to are, you know, being picketed? No, of course not. But at the same time, I understand that it's a complicated issue.
Then you're like, wow.
I will also say that I think one of the things that's hard for the people I know who are dealing with it is that it feels like there should be a distinction, and maybe there should, maybe there shouldn't, between people who are, say, smaller galleries who are moving there because that is where they can afford the rent, and people who are... I think your timing on the apple eating might
perfect.
Be my favorite ever. Sorry. Both times. I know it made my evening. So, I do think that should there be a distinction between, you know, LA galleries who are moving there and opening a space possibly for the first time because this is where they can afford to pay rent for a space that is just big enough to do what they feel is a significant exhibition, versus a lot of what the other thing that we're seeing, which is, you know, New York galleries that are perceived as having more money and moving to Los Angeles and taking a very, very large space. And the way that perhaps is even more sort of taking advantage of a neighborhood and space that could be used in other ways.
Yeah, Gavin Brown has a gallery, and he showed about a year ago, maybe 2 years ago, Gavin Brown had an artist who had made a sculpture. It was a chair and maybe a table of a African-American woman. You were actually sitting, like she was holding the table up for you. Mm. It was gross. It was just really gross. And he got a lot of flack for it. And he doubled down, and he basically said, how can we worry about these petty arguments when global warming is going to subsume us all? And it was like, huh? And he basically was like, I'm more ethical than you because global warming exists. It was this whole thing. So here he is gentrifying this neighborhood and everybody else is being beaten up over it. But I will say, I, for years, when I went to Cal State LA, I took the 251, the MTA bus, or it was called the RTD back then. I took the 251 up Soto, right through the heart of Boyle Heights. And there's a Pioneer Chicken there. There's always been a Pioneer Chicken there. That's like, you know. Come on, Pioneer Chicken.
That's old school.
That's, and it still tastes the same. I tried it the other day. So, but there was Carnitas Michoacan Khan across the street from it, and they just closed Carnitas Michoacan Khan, okay? And they're saying, oh, that's a sign of gentrification. But it's going to be a Panda Express.
Ooh.
Panda Express is like worse than Carnitas Michoacan Khan.
Oh,
it's fast food.
Yeah.
It's cheaper and bulkier and grosser. But to me, so what I'm really questioning is, will the development that takes place in Boyle Heights, the proposed development that's going on, will that actually gentrify it? Because look at Highland Park, which has been gentrified. There's a lot of hipster coffee shops and a lot of art galleries and, oh, people going, oh, Highland Park's been gentrified. But you go to Highland Park and it's still kind of Highland Park, you know. It's not as Highland Park as it was maybe 15 years ago. A lot's changed, but not a lot. It's still Highland Park. It's still, you know, it's still kind of Highland Park. So I'm wondering if New York neighborhoods are very small and contained and are easily gentrified, I believe. And the sprawling nature of LA neighborhoods like Boyle Heights, like Highland Park, there will be an incursion of what we might call a boho, a gentrification. But I don't believe that they can be totally, you know, even the Arts District right around the corner from Houserworth and Schimmel. I mean, within an eighth of a mile of Houserworth and Schimmel, is Central LA's welfare department,
right,
where they line up. If you want your welfare, you got to get there in line. People start lining up at 6 a.m. to be the first one in there to get the welfare benefits processed.
Right.
So, I mean, this stuff kind of like, you know, it's still.
Well, it doesn't mean that, you know, the identity of a neighborhood is erased, but the the idea is that if the changes aren't benefiting the people who originally occupied the neighborhood, then the gentrification is a problem, but right? See, if people then, are priced then, out.
And that's the argument that, okay, so the argument that, oh, so poor people don't deserve the opportunity to have good coffee or don't, you know, they deserve boarded up storefronts instead of an art gallery. You know, they should stay poor and in that neighborhood rather than if they're displaced or maybe benefit from a neighborhood that is improving. So, you know, like they can only have a Winchell's, they can't have an independent gluten-free donut shop.
Well, but if the Winchell's, if the Winchell's is run by somebody who lives in the neighborhood and then but there are places that are equivalents of that, right? Mm-hmm. So if you have, you know, there was something on Facebook and I wish I could remember it better, about a poster that people were calling the Gentra Flyer, that was up in the downtown arts district across from Boyle Heights that was advertising, you know, why rent in the arts district when you can buy on Boyle Heights, right? And that they were going to do, right, that they were going to do this tour and they were going to offer.
But you'd be amazed, drive up Soto Street and count the corporate chains versus the mom and pop shops. It's I would say it's probably 2/3. I mean, you know, like I said, there's McDonald's, Pioneer Chicken, you know, that famous, there's a famous mural of the wedding couple dancing by East Los Streetscapers on the side of this building at First and Soto. It's a Payless shoe store. What's mom and pop about Payless shoes, you know, except your mom and pop taking you to Payless shoes. And mine did. So I just wonder how gentrified it's possible. Is it possible to gentrify Boyle Heights? I'm positing that it may be impossible to gentrify Boyle Heights. And if Highland Park is an example, it's kind of gentrified, but it's not compared to what happened in Soho and other neighborhoods in New York. It's not gentrified at all.
Yes and no. I mean, if you go to, I don't want to debate this forever, but just if you go to the new park that they built and with play structure in Highland Park, you know, 80% of the kids that you see there are white. And for somebody who, you know, maybe grew up in Highland Park 30 years ago and wants to go back there and has kids and sees that, it's going to feel like it's been gentrified to the point of exclusion to the people the community was originally serving. So
is that the country we want to live in, though?
I don't know.
I need to talk to my brother. I'll get back to you on that.
No, I just mean, I'm arguing the other side here. I think it's, again, just always coming back to, I think it's a very complicated issue that has quite a lot going for it.
I do wish Boyle Heights had a higher rate of home ownership. And I think we would be seeing a different
native home ownership.
Well, should people in Boyle Heights who, you know, should native Latinos who live in Boyle Heights be allowed to sell their house to the highest bidder, even if that bidder is white? Should they or should they not? That's really, I mean, what do they owe the community? Huh?
Mostly I just said, don't go there, Deb. If you're listening from any of the Boyle Heights activist communities, please get in touch with Michael so that you can be on the show and present your point of view much, 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 much better than
I'll be able to. I'm at Pioneer Chicken about every 3 weeks. If you at
you want to confront
Matt. Go talk to Matt at Pioneer Chicken.
Soto and Whittier Boulevard.
Peaceful protests only, please.
When they ask for the gavacho with blue hair, that's me.
Go talk to Matt.
Well, we have broken a record.
Uh-oh.
It's the new longest episode.
Hot air.
at just under 2 hours and 30 minutes.
The balloon's flying.
We're actually, we're clearing 227 right
I'm
now.
I'm impressed.
Yes. Oh. Well, Matt, this has been 10 minutes entertaining.
10 minutes of that was a bathroom break.
So. That's true. We're down to 217. It's still a record.
Thanks for that.
Still a record. Oh, shit. Okay.
It's been entertaining. It's been fun. Thanks so much.
See you at Pioneer Chicken, folks.
Thank you. Thank you, Deb.
My pleasure. It's good to be here.
Chris, thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
Here, I'll give you the last word.
Thanks, everybody.
And
we're out.
All right.
Yay. That was fun.
That was super fun.
All right, there you go. Thank you again to Matt Gleason. He did, by the way, he did say he had a great time, despite the chaos there at the end. So he did thank me. Thanks, Matt. And thanks, Deb Cloudman, for taking a lot of the burden off of me, particularly in that Boyle Heights section. Thank you for doing that. Thanks, Chris Ford, for making it all happen once again. And thank you for listening. So before we go, wanted to get to some bad advice and also just quickly remind you that you can become a fan of the show on social media. That is at Artist Podcast on Instagram, on Twitter. You can follow on Facebook as well. And if you haven't yet given a nice review on iTunes, that will help more people find the show. That is linked through the website. Or if you are on iTunes, you can just type in The Conversation on Artist Podcast. Thank you very much in advance for that. And spread the word, of course. It's much appreciated about the show. So now let's get to some bad advice for the week, courtesy of Kate Mitchell. Art has to move you, and design does not, unless it's a good design for a bus. David Hockney. Because of Legos, children understand my painting. But they don't understand the pathos, because they haven't suffered. At least I hope they haven't suffered. Sean Scully. And finally, this is in the winds right now, appropriate to the winds right now. It's from Edi Rama, who is Albania's prime minister and also an artist, apparently with a show at a high-profile gallery. I don't know what gallery that is, but in any case, this comes from Jeff Weiss's newsletter. Politics with its insanity can make art even better. And that's from Edi Rama. Thank you very much again for listening. I appreciate it. I hope you enjoyed that. I hope you will come back next week, and I hope you'll spread the word. Thank you for listening, and I will talk to you next week. Ciao for now.